Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. We are joined today by Tim Jackson, who is Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey and Director of the Centre for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. He is also an award-winning playwright with numerous radio writing credits for the BBC. Tim is perhaps most well known for his best-selling book, Prosperity Without Growth. He has recently published a revised second edition, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Tim. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello, Barry.
Okay, well, maybe could we begin by you telling us a little bit more about yourself and how this second edition evolved?
Yes. I mean, the original work was something that came from a period of my life when I was Economics Commissioner on the Sustainable Development Commission, which was an advisory body to the UK government. It doesn't exist anymore, which is one of the slight sort of ironies perhaps of the whole work that we did, that maybe the government didn't quite see the place for advisors who were giving them such challenging advice. And the nature of the challenge was kind of to say, actually, guys, the way you're doing the economy at the moment, the way you're chasing growth in the GDP all the time at the moment, may actually not be the best way to ensure prosperity for people. And so its guiding question really is, what can prosperity, what can it mean? What can it possibly mean on a finite planet with, you know, upwards of 7 billion and fast approaching 10 billion people living on it? And surely it can't mean what we've taken it to mean in the past, which is, you know, having ever more stuff, ever bigger incomes, which we spend on lots of lovely consumer goods, which are great fun at the time, but don't sometimes necessarily even contribute to prosperity in very meaningful ways. So there are two various bits of that question is, you know, what does prosperity actually really mean? What does it mean to live well?
Yeah.
And then how do you make your economic systems work when you have a good guiding model of prosperity? My whole work over the last 25 years, I suppose, has been driven by that set of questions. And obviously, I've been led towards those questions by various things. By, first of all, the challenge of environmental limits, then also the challenge of resources and finite resources, and then challenges like inequality, because our existing system creates a lot of inequality, and that's actually not very good for prosperity at all. And then finally, almost exactly the time that our initial report was published, by the financial crisis itself, which sort of said, actually, the model in its own terms is not very successful at the moment. It's created these huge financial instabilities, and the only way of getting rid of the instabilities is for governments funded by the taxpayer to put even more money in the hands of the banks and the financial institutions to stabilize them. So money going in the wrong direction in terms of inequality and reducing inequality. And I suppose that's the journey, particularly between the first edition of the book in 2009, so just after the crisis, and the second edition of the book, which I published earlier this year. Is that kind of understanding that actually it's not an environmentalist debate anymore? It's not a sort of radical green debate. It's become a kind of mainstream economic debate that actually our growth-based economy is running out of steam, creating inequality and trashing the planet. And it's the fact that it's not working in its own terms, I think, that really sort of motivated the second edition, alongside the environmental concerns, obviously, but also with a much more urgent an urgent motivation at its very heart is the question of, you know, what does the economy of tomorrow look like?
Yeah.
How can we create an economy that works for everyone? and how we can we do that in the face not just of these environmental limits, but actually now of these much more much closer to home economic challenges that we're facing.
Okay, well, we can explore that side of it a bit later, but maybe we should kick off with trying to unpack a bit more what prosperity actually is.
Yeah, and that was my starting point too, really, and it's a fascinating starting point, because the idea that prosperity is just about our income level or our GDP is actually quite a modern construction. And if it stands at all, it stands in the face of a kind of storm of protest from all those who say, actually, no, you know, my well-being, my quality of life, my sense of identity, my participation in society, all of these things are what prosperity is, not just my income level. And that's not just to, that's not to say, of course, that income doesn't matter. It clearly does matter. And it matters in particular when you don't have any. And in the poorest communities, actually, you have to be able to say that improving prosperity has to be about having some more secure income levels. But it is it's a very solid recognition in literature, in poetry, in philosophy, in the faith traditions, in sociological studies, in psychology, and just in everyday life. You know, you go out and ask people what matters to you. And of course, they, at some point, they'll say income, but they most likely to say first, actually, they're most likely to say health. And then they will talk a little bit about their family and their relationships. And then they'll talk about their sense of community. And then they'll talk about having a sense of meaning and purpose, having a way of participating in society, having some sense of autonomy and control over their lives. And they will also talk about, you know, particularly their children and future generations, and a sense of continuity. And these insights into what really matters to people are so wide ranging and so profoundly different from a simple perspective that says, you know, as long as you have more money, then you're better off, that they're a very powerful way of reframing prosperity.
Yeah, okay, then. So why without growth? Why prosperity without growth?
Well, that's the, I mean, it started off as a sort of question, because, you know, the question that we started with in the Sustainable Development Commission was, you know, we're living on a finite planet, mate. You keep growing and growing and growing in material terms, aren't you going to run out of planet sooner or later? And there's a very famous quote from an economist called Kenneth Balding, who sort of said, anyone who thinks that exponential growth can continue indefinitely on a finite planet is either a madman or an economist.
Yeah.
and that is basically how economists frame prosperity. They frame it as the GDP, and so, you know, increasing prosperity, improving prosperity is traditionally having more and more growth, having more and more output, and in exponential terms, you know, 2% or 3% bigger next year than it was this year, and bigger the year after that than it will be next year, and growing at that exponential rate. And the one thing we know about those exponential growth rates is that, you know, in the beginning you don't really notice that 2% extra because you didn't start with very much, but at the end it becomes a huge, you're talking about really gigantic increases in the context of a planet and of a set of resources that just stays fixed. So it really does raise the question, you know, what if we can't do this growth-based thing because we live on a finite planet? Where do we get prosperity from? So separating out prosperity from growth was very much what we were trying to do, and having that conversation, you know, what do we do about prosperity if we can't get this growth stuff anymore, certainly in the way that we've had it? And the really fascinating thing is that that original question for us was driven by environmental parameters, by the fact that growth increases exponentially, increases our output exponentially, increases our resource needs year on year, but we only have finite resources and a finite planet. But one of the things that's happened between the first and the second edition is the sort of running out of growth generally. So after the crisis, we thought it was all about financial instability, and we thought financial instability was to do with rogue behaviours by banks and by borrowers and lenders, and a lax financial regulation regime which allowed things just to get out of control. But in the intervening few years, we've kind of discovered that that growth didn't come back so easily. Even when we put a bit more financial control there, even when we bailed out the banks, even when the debt that consumers had was put a bit more under control, not much, it has to be said, but a bit more under control, even then we weren't really getting back to the sort of growth-based world at the rate that we thought we would have it in the past. And so there's a kind of new normal, a slow realization that maybe we're going into a kind of new normal in which the growth rates are lower than they were before, and possibly quite soon, particularly in the advanced economies, we just might not have that rate of growth that we had in the past.
Yeah.
And some of the analysis sort of says, actually, this is nothing to do with the crisis. This is a process that's been going on since the middle of the last century, a gradual slowing down of the growth rates, particularly in advanced economies, because we had those big scientific discoveries. We got the huge productivity growth that came from those. And when we had this big boom of fossil fuels and the industrialization that came off the back of that, and that gave us all of this lovely productivity and the ability to expand forever. But actually, when you look at the numbers and the data, you find it's now beginning very, very slowly, but very surely to decline, that a potential to grow. And now we're in a different set of questions, you know, a really fascinating place in its own right. If that's the case, if growth is running out of steam, if the new normal is a low growth environment, where on earth do we get prosperity from?
Very interesting, yeah. But I also sometimes think, you know, if you listen to the media or politicians, the connection between the finiteness of our situation and growth, it's not really been discussed, not in the UK anyway. If you get on the Radio 4 Today program, they talk about we need growth without batting an eyelid. Why does it pose as such a dilemma?
It's a fascinating. I mean, I think there are lots of different answers to that. In a way, one of them is that we're just it's almost like the reaction to not having growth is visceral for politicians, for businesses, for banks, because we have built all our institutions around the idea that we're going to have that. And we haven't. It's not as though we've done it mindlessly. We've done it with the idea that actually, you know, growth does improve the quality of people's lives. And when you look at the data on that, you find that there are certain places where it really does. At the beginning, when you don't have clean water and you don't have proper houses and you don't have enough nutrition to sustain your health, then actually, you know, having a bit more income really does make a difference. And you can see this in the statistics. You can see how in the poorest countries with incomes of less than £5,000, the life expectancy is 40 or 50 years. But then as you grow, as your income grows to, say, £15,000 a year, that life expectancy almost doubles. So, you know, you have countries with incomes of around $10,000 per capita, let's say, and they have life expectancies already at that point of 70 and 80 years, which is very comparable to what we have in the rich economies with incomes, average incomes of $30,000-$40,000 per capita. So what you see there is actually there is that place where growth matters, and there is a rationale for it, which it has brought us out of abject poverty and improved our nutrition. But actually, you also see the converse side of that question. There's like diminishing returns after about $15,000 per capita. That increase in income doesn't translate into a massive increase in life expectancy. It doesn't translate into a massive increase in people's education. It doesn't translate into a massive increase in their happiness. And so it's like we're chasing growth at this point, but without the corresponding increase in prosperity. And sometimes we're even undermining prosperity, because in order to keep growth going, we have to have everyone running around buying things faster and faster, working harder and harder to earn the income to spend on the goods that, you know, are supposed to improve the quality of our lives, but actually sometimes just weigh us down because we've become overburdened by stuff. And so, you know, the challenge for us, particularly in the advanced economies, is something like this. It's something like, you know, how on earth could we think about more prosperity, but with less material throughput? How could we think about living better by consuming less? Or how could we think about having, you know, more fun with less stuff?
Yeah, I really like that. That's a good way of framing it.
It is. It does. And it sort of resonates with people because they get that idea that, you know, at a certain point, the material things in life are absolutely crucial. But as you accumulate more and more and more of this material stuff and you have access to more and more of it, actually becomes more of a burden than it does a blessing. And it would be wrong to say that that's where we all are in advanced economies, because we're absolutely not. There are very, very poor people and there are very, very rich people. And it's a real challenge. In a way, it's mostly a challenge for people who are, you know, have those comforts of life already satisfied, and where discretionary consumption is all about having more things, having more material impact. But sometimes just working in order to be able to do that without really seeing the prosperity gain that you would want to be seeing from it.
Yeah, yeah. When I bring this subject up in conversation, many people think we can outsmart the problems. I had a conversation about this an hour or so ago with a friend. We can outsmart the problems growth brings by being more efficient and coming up with new technologies. Why do you think that is to a degree problematic?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, actually, there's a, you know, I've been in this game for quite a long time, and when I started out, I really started out actually mostly along those lines, I would say, you know, thinking how do we get round these problems with technology? So if we've got fossil fuel energy production, which is pumping carbon into the atmosphere, it seems like obvious. Let's look for something, an energy production which doesn't do that. Can we find them? Yes, of course we can. Renewable energy, you know, most obvious example, wind energy, photovoltaics, all that kind of thing, solar power. That's the response, is to say, yeah, we've got clever technology here which will reduce the carbon potentially almost to nothing, and let's get that in place. So the difficulty, where does it become problematic? It becomes problematic in a variety of ways, I think. Firstly, that actually the scale that you've got to decouple, the scale of technological improvement, decoupling it's called, so you decouple your GDP from the material inputs to that GDP, or from the carbon emissions, let's say, to that GDP. The scale is absolutely huge if we want to have a chance of meeting our carbon targets. So you've really got to, you know, within the space of a couple of decades, you've got to totally decarbonize the economy, and you've got to try and do that without, you know, trashing all your land use patterns, deforesting all your rainforest and the habitats for all the people and the species that depend on that environment. And you've got to do it without drawing down all the scarce resources, and you've got to do it faster than anything has ever occurred in the industrial economy in the entire history of our civilization. So that's the, you know, that's the challenge. It's huge. And I think my approach to that challenge is not to say, no, don't be stupid, you can't possibly do that. It's to say, can we make that transition in our kind of economy? And that's where you have to start looking at, you know, what our kind of economy is. And it's an economy that's built around certain principles. It's built around growth. It's built around consumerism. It's built around profit maximization. And it's built around it in ways that reinforce each other, so that actually, you know, if you start talking about stopping that growth engine, you start upsetting businesses, you start upsetting investors, you start upsetting banks, you start upsetting politicians, you start upsetting shareholders, you start upsetting the stock market, you know, things start to go unstable. And this is where the visceral fear comes from. You know, you're not just having an intellectual argument about the potential for technological efficiency. You're having an argument that is about fundamental beliefs in our society. And there's an element of that discussion. There's an element of why it's so difficult to have that discussion, which is around the fact that growth has assumed a kind of semi-religious sacred status in our society. And that's how people respond when you start to question it. But all that shows to me is, you know, there's an absolute need for us to question it, because when a belief becomes so ideological and so and to some extent so immune to reason that we can't even talk about it anymore, then we're in a really dangerous situation, because we're running as a society with a set of rules and beliefs that is actually racing us towards destruction rather than towards prosperity.
Sure, yeah. Just continue on this subject of beliefs and maybe reflecting back a little bit on what you said about either being Madden or an economist. Just perhaps certain dogmatic beliefs at the heart of consumerist capitalism exacerbate the problem. I'm thinking of, for example, the invisible hand of the free market and the idea that our basic nature is one of self-interest, that we're in effect, I think they use the term in economics, we're homo economicus. Aren't we as much homo empathicus as we're homo economicus?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I talk about this quite a lot. It came in really early to the project for me, that, you know, you start with this question that seems to be about resources and technology. But very quickly, as soon as you start looking at what makes the system run, you sort of end up inside yourself, you know, you end up inside your own kind of motivations, who we are as human beings and who we see ourselves as human beings. And I think you're absolutely right that what economics does is it sees human beings as broadly selfish, but then it uses this, like, it's like a magic trick. You know, Adam Smith said it in a totally different context, it has to be said, but his broad argument was that it is this selfishness that allows for the social good to emerge. And the way that he made that link was through this invisible hand. Each person is led as if by an invisible hand to do the best thing for society. But all they started out with was doing things for their own interest. And what he was trying to say was that, you know, if you had a very open community-based society, you might, as a butcher or a baker, you know, be motivated in your work by your own selfish desire to have an income, but you could never outprice your competitors in the market because you would immediately be visible as a fraud. You could never sell low quality goods because people would just not come back to you. You could never, you know, create a whole bunch of external costs on the rest of society because you would be out there visible and the social approbation would stop you doing that. And so he set up a sort of ideal case, I suppose, where the hypothesis was true that you could, through selfishness, get to a place where everybody's interaction as potentially selfish merchants meant that you had a good outcome in terms of society.
Yeah.
And what economics basically did was said, okay, right, we're selfish. Everyone knows that. Darwin told us even, you know, shortly after Adam Smith was working. And Adam Smith said selfishness can lead to the social good. So that's great. Let's create an economics in which we're all selfish people, and that'll be the best for society. And it is, quite frankly, the most malinformed, pernicious myth on which you could possibly have based society. It just is not true. You know, it's a case that you could make in a particular set of circumstances in a sort of society that no longer exists almost anywhere, but it is absolutely not true to say that human beings are just about selfishness.
No.
And a lot of modern psychology really, you know, makes that point very strongly, that we're social, empathetic, altruistic sometimes. And we care, you know, we're not just hedonists. We care about the past, the future. We care about each other. We care about the places that we live in. We even have, you know, deep connections to our physical environment, the environment around us. And all these insights just went missing from economics altogether and created a sort of fantasy economics in a way, an economics built upon a myth that's been falsified over and over again.
Okay, so with this recognition, with this now greater understanding that we have of human nature and the human condition, what would an economy of tomorrow look like that nurtured and protected what matters most to us?
Yeah, that's really one of the things that I tried to do very much more in the second edition of the book than I did in the first, was exactly to ask that question and to ask it in a quite sort of disciplined way. So, you know, we're inclined to think, for example, that the economy is about things like enterprise, and it's things like work, and it's things like investment, and it's things like money. And in the set of institutions that we now call economics, this rather dysfunctional place with its mad idea about selfishness at the heart of it, they all work in a very particular way. But what if we took these principles and said, you know, what could enterprise, for example, actually be? And instead of having it as a kind of, you know, profit maximizing division of labor that tries to produce more and more stuff as fast and fast as it possibly can and trashes the planet in the process, what if we think about enterprise in a different way? What if we think about it actually as us, as human beings, working in the service of other human beings, producing things that improve the quality of our lives, but also in the process of working with these enterprises, improving the quality of our own lives, because yeah, we're participating through our work in improving the quality of lives of others. And that's like saying, actually, you know, there are two things that matter there that go completely missing from economics. One is that we care about the impact that we have on other people, that we are social in that respect. And the other is that we are deeply creative, purposive beings who actually want to have an intrinsic motivation to be productive, and productive in the service of others. And that transformation, that lens, actually, to me, it didn't sort of come out of the blue. It came from a whole literature of people who talked about work differently, but also who talked about technology differently, and recognized that actually it's not the stuff that technology delivers that ultimately we want, even. It's the service which that stuff provides. So even something as basic as energy, you know, we can't eat coal and oil, and if we breathe gas, we tend to make ourselves very ill. So there's no direct relationship to the fossil fuels themselves. It's the service they can provide us with that is so valuable. Yeah. And there are lots of different ways of thinking about that service. You know, if you're in a very drafty house, you have to burn much more gas or oil or coal to get the service of warmth. But if you insulate that house, if you refurbish it, if you design it in a different way, then you have a whole range of different technological ways of providing that service. And you have a whole range of different social ways of providing that service. And that's the core of the kind of transformation, actually, is to think about each of those things, enterprise, work, investment, money, in a way that's driven by different principles than the ones that drive conventional economics. And what's, to me, extraordinary about that task is once you start on it, you begin to see that it's entirely definable. It's very pragmatic. You begin to see what your enterprise looks like and what kinds of things your economy is made of. And it's meaningful. It's a sort of meaningful thing for a government to build an industrial strategy around, for example, or for an enterprise to structure itself around. It puts unfamiliar things back on the territory. It says, you know, actually business, as much as anything else, is about purpose rather than about profit. It says that money is a social good, not just a means of selfish accumulation. It talks about investment as a commitment to the future rather than as what it sort of became in the run-up to the crisis, a sort of, you know, a gambling casino where a few people got very rich and the rest of the economy got trashed. So that's the process, really, that I tried to explore more in the second book than in the first, of this very, very practical, meaningful approach to what the economy would look like if you took some of these things seriously.
Yeah, and what for you is the legitimate role of government in all this, and what would need to be its essential policies in this post-growth society?
Yeah, along with this idea that, you know, if you just let everybody be selfish, the market will work out, the invisible hand will play its role, and everything will turn out well. Along with that idea came a real trashing of the idea of governance in any sense. Government was seen as, you know, either something that just was big, centrist, bureaucratic, stood in the way of progress, or as something that was corrupted by the power of big corporations and the money that was involved in that. And I think this is one of our biggest challenges, particularly at the moment with the politics of the day, is that, you know, the notion of governance and of good governance has been really tarnished, mm-hmm. partly by that intellectual fabrication, but also by the way that it's actually been manipulated by power interests to seize control of governance and to rob it of its social effectiveness. And I think that's, you know, it is a profound challenge, but it's absolutely central to what we need to do, is to reclaim from government this idea that it's a corrupt, conflicted place which is inefficient, and actually replace it with some of the basic ideas that informed governance when we emerged as a civilized society. It was about a social contract. It was about saying, actually, there's places where, as a group, we agree to curtail some of our freedoms for the social good. It's a place where we give powers to a certain set of people to make sure that those who would like to corrupt and free ride on that system are not allowed to do so, where we support social goals and we underpin the ethics of almost compassion and care for each other through these institutions. And that's the role to me of governance in this debate. It's not about imposing centrist control. It's about supporting that element of ourselves which is social, which is altruistic, which brings out the best in us, and creating the institutions that allow us to do that. I think where the policies come out of that is that under this idea that government should just get out of the way, and that we should allow everything to happen through the markets, and that if you encourage selfishness, you'll get to the social good. We've set up our policies in the past. They've all been driven by that idea. And so we've set up policies that reward greed, that incentivize competition, that create deregulated markets, and ultimately bore a lot of the responsibility for things like the financial crisis. And so when it comes to specific policies, we've got two things we have to do. One of them is to actually recognize the extent to which we've skewed the existing system towards that ideal of selfish competition and start to dismantle that. And the other is to reinforce, to think about government as a place that reinforces and nurtures community and builds resilience. And, you know, for example, in the financial sector, that makes it possible for people to invest for good rather than penalizing them for doing so.
Yeah. And you're not talking about a utopia here, are you? Or is all living in yurts?
It's not utopia. It's, you know, in a way, it's kind of saying we've lived for too long under a kind of false utopia. The idea that we could have more and more forever and ever, things would get brighter and shinier because we had all this fantastic technology and very clever ingenuity and more stuff, and that we can solve all our problems on the way by doing that. That to me is the utopian vision. This is like saying, ground yourselves in reality, guys. The planet is finite. We're not running out of resources tomorrow, but we are creating these devastating impacts on the quality of the planet. And we're doing it with an economy that is fundamentally out of whack, has created huge inequalities and maybe running out of steam. Now is the time not to think about utopia, but actually, what on earth are we going to do to protect prosperity at this point in time?
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. The middle way, Tim, as we understand it in the middle way society, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those beliefs are positive or negative. That then throws us back on experience, so we're left in this sort of messy, uncertain middle, but it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we can actually start to get to grips more adequately with whatever phenomena we encounter. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
I think it does, you know, because firstly, that middle way, you know, the distance between utopia and ideology is very, very short. You know, you have your idea of what utopia should be, and very quickly you fix the principles. And then as soon as you fix principles, it becomes ideological. And when it becomes ideological, you can never ask the questions that you need to be asking to have realistic chances in the real world of feasible solutions. And that's exactly what this process has been about for me. It's been about challenging that utopian dogma and saying this is the point at which we need to get a bit messy. We don't exactly know where we're going here, but for goodness sake, let's open up the space for conversation. We don't exactly know what these institutions will look like, but we do know they don't look like these dysfunctional things that led us towards crisis. We don't exactly know, you know, how our enterprises are all going to become the places where we live and work and deliver all the services. But there are lots of people, and this has been another of the insights since the first edition, many, many people and institutions and enterprises actually going out there doing it. And that's the mess. That's the messy place.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, it's fascinating actually for me now seeing this kind of ocean of different kinds of ways of approaching enterprise and different kinds of funds to finance this new vision of the economy and different kinds of social organization, you know, young kids coming out of college saying, I don't want to do things that way anymore because actually it's led towards destruction. I want my life to have a purpose and I want it to work in this way, setting up very experimental enterprises, startups in different ways, or going into the mainstream existing companies and saying, my position here is only tenable to me from the point of view of my conscience if we can change things, and being agents of change inside the beast. And that's a huge inspiration. The inspirational space is there right in the middle of this mess, but with a belief that it's possible to create change.
Great. Just a personal question. I mentioned earlier on that you also have another career as a playwright. Do you think that way of looking at things has helped you to see the bigger picture with regard to economics?
I think it probably has. I mean, to be honest, it started as a kind of survival. Well, it's where my heart was right in the beginning, was in playwriting. And I kept it going through my academic work, really as a kind of survival strategy without really thinking about it. I just knew that I had to do it. It made the rest of academic life kind of bearable. And as I began, I began to analyze that. And one of the things that was really fascinating was that when you're an academic, you're supposed to make a case. You know, sometimes if you're a real professional academic, you make any kind of case that will draw some attention to you, whether it's radical or offbeat or whatever. And then you spend your life kind of protecting that territorial space. You become the voice of a particular viewpoint or a particular theory, and you build your career around that. Playwriting is totally different. You can be anybody you want. You can espouse any view that you want. Yeah. You know, and actually, if you try and keep a particular view in a play, you lose the drama. Because actually the drama comes from the way that those ideas come together and sometimes conflict with each other. And I think that, you know, what sustainability and the sustainability discourse quite often tries to do is it tries to flatten that conflict landscape, you know, to take the conflict out of the way and say, don't worry, guys, everything's going to be okay. We can have double dividends and triple dividends. It can be win-win. We can solve everything. And actually, the dramatist in me is much more drawn to that what comes out of that conflict landscape as being a very, very productive place where you can just be a totally different voice. So some of the plays I think that I, you know, that I, where my characters have really come to life, they've almost been like an alter ego. You know, they've almost adopted a totally opposite position than the one that I would adopt if I was on an academic stage somewhere putting forth a paper. And that's that creativity, I think, of, you know, allowing yourself to occupy these different positions. That's definitely contributed in the end to this kind of work.
Yeah, it sounds fun too. And my last question, Tim, how hopeful are you about the future?
It's amazing how often I get asked this question, and I have only, after, you know, testing out lots of different answers to it, I have only one, which is that I think hope is, and it's a funny kind of word, hope, really, but it's really, I think, is a pragmatic decision. What's the point in giving up hope? There is, if you don't want to change anything, if you want your life to be crap, if you want to be constantly bombarded day in and day out by the impossibility of any kind of quality of life, then by all means give up hope. But if you don't want that, and it is at the end of the day a kind of a choice, then keep hope on the table.
Yeah,
it's kind of almost, you know, the sort of place of sporting analogies. But if you give up hope because you're on the losing side and there's only 15 minutes to go before the final whistle, you know you can predict the outcome, but if you maintain hope, that outcome suddenly becomes unpredictable. And as we know, I mean, all the most wonderful sort of sporting stories, in a sense, emerge from the unpredictability that happens when people refuse to give up hope. And that's my kind of practical position on it.
Oh, that's a great answer. Anyway, thank you very much for talking to me today, Tim. It's been a real pleasure. And for anyone listening out there, I've read both books and I enjoyed them most. I have to say that I found the second one more accessible. And I think that was part of your rationale as well, that it was a more academic slant to the first one, whereas this was pitched more at a lay audience. Well, I'm definitely that lay audience.
That's really pleased me, actually, because that is very much what I wanted the second book to do. Yeah,
well, that certainly worked for me anyway. So anyway, thank you very much, Tim.
Brilliant. Thanks, Barry.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.